All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And, you know, I was listening earlier on, and I heard that Herman Wallace only has a few days to live. And I thought about him and Lynn Stewart. And I thought, let's do the show in honor of Lynn Stewart and Herman Wallace today. Let's do the show in honor of people who stood up against this system, this brutal human-eating system, and has been hit by it, pushed down by it, beaten up by it, not beaten, but still stand strong as they can. And so this goes out to Herman Wallace and Lynn Stewart. And again, for those of you who don't know, Herman Wallace was one of the Angola Three down at Angola Prison in Louisiana. He started a Black Panther chapter in Angola Prison, one of the first prison chapters of the Black Panther Party. And Herman has been in jail for far more than 40 years. And in fact, he's the person who has spent the most time in solitary confinement in this country. He's been in solitary for more than 40 years. And for those of you who don't know about Lynn Stewart is an attorney. She's a revolutionary attorney, and she spent her life defending revolutionaries and other activists who dare to stand up against this system. And in fact, she was thrown into jail a number of years back for actually daring to defend one of her clients. Okay, and so the show today goes out to Herman Wallace and Lynn Stewart. So on that note, at the back end of the show, I'm really, really happy about this part of the show. Well, I'm happy about the whole show, but this one in particular. We're going to be talking with two of the actors from The Normal Heart, and that's a play that was written by Larry Kramer, AIDS activist and founder of ACT UP. And it's a great play, and it concentrates so much of what needs to be talked about today, and we'll get into that when we get back at that end of the show. But opening the show up, I'm extremely pleased to be welcoming back to the show Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And he's also part of the October 22nd Coalition. He's one of the founding members of the October 22nd Coalition. And I wanted to have Carl in to talk about this today because I want to give people enough time to really get their gears sort of meshed up and moving around what's coming up towards the end of October, October 22nd. I wanted to talk to Carl about police brutality, resistance, how to resolve it, how to solve it. Can it be solved under this system? And why not? We'll get into all this with Carl. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Sure. Well, we've got quite a bit of time to explore some of these questions, and I wanted to dig into them with you as much as we can. All right, so let's start out with this. October 22nd, as I said, it's coming up. It's the 18th National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation. So, down on the ground for people who might not know what exactly that is. What is it and what's it about?
Well, the October 22nd National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality was an initiative taken to take the resistance to the police brutality, police murder, and the repression and treating of whole generations of young people as criminals, guilty until proven innocent, if they can survive to prove their innocence. And this was a step that we took back in 1996. And if anything, it is even more relevant today when you look at, first off, just the aftermath of the verdict, the lynching verdict in the Trayvon Martin case, where you have a court declaring that a young black man can be stalked, confronted, and murdered for no reason other than that he's young and black, and that no crime was committed. And that really concentrates the continuance and the intensification of the criminalization of black and Latino youth, plus just the continuing deluge of murders, brutality on the part of police and other law enforcement agents, and the fact that they almost always get away with those crimes. So there is more necessity than ever for people to step out, to take to the streets, to hold teach-ins, cultural events, and in other ways raise a strong, powerful, united voice to say no more to these official atrocities.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me this, Carl. What makes this so different than any other demonstration? Why should people be out there? Let's talk about that, because, you know, people are going to say, like, look, man, we have demonstration after demonstration after demonstration. What makes this so different, and why should I be out there?
Okay, well, there's two things that I think need to be brought out in relation to that. The first is that what happens on October 22nd is that it is a day when the victims of police brutality, police murder, are given a platform from which to speak about what was done to their loved ones and how it devastated their families, and to speak about the demonization that led to the murders of their loved ones, and a day when people from other walks of life, other sections of society, are brought out to stand with them and support them and stand together with them against these atrocities. The other thing is that this year, given the Trayvon Martin case, given that verdict and the way in which it reinforced something that was said by the U.S. Supreme Court back in 1857, that black people have no rights that white people are bound to respect, there is a real necessity for the outrage that people felt off of that verdict and for the broad questioning of the injustice of this society to not be allowed to die down, to not be allowed to go away. But people who felt slapped in the face or punched in the gut by that verdict really need to be mobilized to step out and to bring that outrage and bring that questioning of where's all this coming from and what can we do about it into the streets on October 22nd, and to really say, we're not going to go back to normal. We're not going to be taken in by a few statements about something is going to be done and somebody's going to work on this. No more of this stuff.
You know, it's interesting, Carl, because one of the things that really strikes me about this every year, and this is, like I said, this is the 18th year, and the fact that actually on that day, it's giving voice to the victims and giving, you know, and the victims coming out and standing up against this. And it's doing it in a way that doesn't just connect in each individual city or town, but it actually, there's been a lot of different expressions across the years. And I thought that one of the things that's really important is you've actually coalesced, I mean, the idea of a coalition, you've coalesced a national movement. You know, and sometimes stronger, sometimes less strong, but there is a real press to bring together a national movement where people can actually be part of standing up against this across the country, and where even if you don't have something, you know, an October 22nd coalition in your city, but you hear about it and you want to do things on that day, that people, there's avenues and ways for people to get involved in this that actually is much more than any single demonstration or whatever, but is actually something where people are coming together in a way that I think really has a different impact overall.
Yeah, and see, this is really important because October 22nd has to a certain degree become the day for people to act on this. And like you're saying, people who don't act all year round, there's a feeling like, okay, but October's coming up, we got to do this. And it needs to be stronger than ever this year, and we're actually working on some forms to make it possible for people to act. There's one thing I want to bring out that is an ongoing thing that the October 22nd Coalition has done, and that's the Stolen Lives Project, which documents the horrific reality of murder at the hands of the police, because this is a project to collect information on people that were killed by the police, how they were killed, and were any cops at all punished for this, which is almost never the case. And it just shows you how widespread this is, that there's no isolated incident character to this. It happens again and again and again. And that's a project that we've documented police killings. The coalition has documented police killings from back in 1990, and it's accessible online at stolenlives.org. And it's a resource that people can use to speak to the reality of this. And then some new things that we're developing. We're going to kick out a project of people doing and posting videos of why they're going to act on October 22nd. I'm going to be doing mine this coming weekend, and I'm going to be wearing a hoodie because I think it's very important to bring Trayvon Martin and what happened to him into the mobilization for October 22nd this year.
Yeah, in fact, isn't that one of the slogans that's being raised this year?
Yeah, one thing that I'm raising in relationship to this, because our slogans have always been stop police brutality, repression, the criminalization of a generation, No More Stolen Lives, Wear Black, Fight Back, because we call for people to wear black on October 22nd, and this year we're adding Hoodies Up as an additional slogan. Call on people to bring their outrage around Trayvon and their feelings about what happened to him into this year's mobilization.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today to Carl Dix. Carl's from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and he's one of the founding members of the October 22nd Coalition. And we're talking about the upcoming National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality. Carl, let's talk about this. I was driving over here today, and I thought about this in terms of, I went past a sign that was out on the main street in my neighborhood, and it was a sign calling for a car wash. You know, it was a car wash that was raising money from people in the neighborhood to help pay for the funeral expenses of a young guy that was killed by the police. And I thought it just brought my mind back to a couple weeks ago where a young man was killed standing in an alley. And the police said they heard a scream in the night. Somebody said, "There's somebody." They went into an alley. They shot him because, after all, he's dangerous. He had something in his hand, and he had a cell phone in his hand. And as it turns out, a week or so later, the cop is, they reveal that the sheriff's said, well, this guy has been involved in seven other shootings. And, we kept putting him out. But this time we think he won't be going on patrol again. You know, and you're sitting there and you're thinking, how much longer is this going to go on? And I wanted to talk to you about this. Has been a hellified time over the last, just the last year, even if you go back beyond that, even more hellified. It just keeps slamming people week after week, day after day, one outrage after another, all kinds of different forms. What do you think the impact of all that is, and how does that all relate to 022?
Well, how it relates, I was sitting down this morning and just thinking about the last month, and like last week, a week and a half ago in New York City, police fired on a guy who was pointing his finger at them like his hand was a gun and shooting in Times Square, with his finger. The cops draw on him, fire at him a couple times, miss him, and hit a couple of bystanders. The same day in North Carolina, cops come upon a guy who has wrecked his car in a one-car accident, who's going around the neighborhood trying to get somebody to help him. And the cops say, well, he rushed us, so we had to shoot him. He was coming to him for help. This goes down. You go back to August and the graffiti artist who was tased to death in Miami Beach, a homeless man in Santa Ana who is shot by a cop for refusing, the order to get on the ground, shot dead by a cop. This stuff is coming like a raging torrent, and it really does pose, what's it going to take to deal with this, and what are you going to do? Are you going to let this go down? Are you going to hope it doesn't hit you? Are you going to realize that what this reflects is that whole sections of people have been criminalized? Like I say, guilty until proven innocent, if they can survive to prove their innocence, and that this is unacceptable, it's outrageous, and it must be stopped, and it's up to people to stand up and stop it. It's part of a larger program. It's one that I have called a slow genocide, targeting black and Latino people, and it stems from the fact that this system has got no future for inner city youth across the country. The factories that their parents and grandparents used to work in have largely been sent halfway around the world, and their program for this is not to figure out, well, how do we give these youth something meaningful to do with their lives, but more, how do we control these youth? So you see police flooding the neighborhoods. You see people being rounded up and warehoused in prison. Then when people get out of prison, they're treated like second-class citizens, and many of them end up on a trajectory of going back into prison. It's something that's referred to as the new Jim Crow, but I think we need to grasp that it is actually making it impossible for broad sections of oppressed people in this country to survive and thrive as a people, which is actually the definition of genocide. It isn't just when you line people up against the wall and shoot them. That's what we're dealing with here, and it's going to take two things. First and foremost, look, it's going to take revolution. getting rid of this system once and for all to end that program. There's no way within the system, and we should talk about that some. At the same time, it's going to take people standing up and resisting, and October 22nd is the day to, on this front around these issues, to stand up and say no more.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today to Carl Dix. Carl's from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and he's one of the founding members of the October 22nd Coalition. And we're talking about the upcoming National Day of Protest against Police Brutality. You know, Carl, all right, well, let's jump into this, because I was going to ask you about this thing about the slow genocide, because I think it's really important, and that so many people, while they can recognize different aspects of that, tying it together in terms of slow genocide is an extremely important thing for people to understand, and how that can be, while that's a slow genocide today, how it can actually, you know, jump into a quick genocide, a very fast genocide. But that's tied up with exactly what you're saying, because this is the kind of thing when you're talking about, you know, and look, I've heard this from a number of people talking about, look, people who have been involved in the October 22nd National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality, you know, they for many years, and they've come and they said, look, I just, you know, we keep demonstrating. And it's more out of frustration. They're not like saying, I'm not going to do it this year, but they're like, you know, look, what do we do? You know, and you're talking about a much bigger framework, a question of it being systemic. Let's dig into that. Let's get into that in terms of, you know, when people talk about, one, what can we do? And you raise the question of revolution. And then people are talking about, so it's systemic. Okay, but how is it systemic? And why would revolution do away with that? Why is it only revolution that'll do away with that?
Yeah, well, let's start on the systemic part, because it really is, you know, I'm not telling a story here to try to back up my position when I say this system has no future to offer these youth. You know, you look at, like, mainstream economists who are projecting that half of the youth in the inner city, who are mostly black and Latino, are never going to find employment in the formal economy, and they're going to be left to the margins looking for hustles. Their approach to that is not, oh my God, we have to do something to change that, to give these youth something meaningful to do in their lives, but how are we going to control the people that we've got no use for? We can't profitably exploit them in our economic system. And it does come down to a program of control and punishment. And that's what we're up against, and that's where the 2 million-plus people in prison come from. That's where the police being unleashed to spread terror and brutality in the inner city communities come from. And it really does come down to that, because when you look at the fact that police kill hundreds of people in the United States every year, that most of the people they kill are unarmed and not involved in any criminal activity, yet cops are almost never punished for doing this, you get a sense that this is being given a green light, being given an okay, because if it were problematic that the cops were killing these unarmed innocent people, you would see cops punished for it, as opposed to them being given the benefit of the doubt when they kill a young person for having a cell phone, when they kill a person for having a candy bar or a cigarette lighter or some other stuff that they claim they thought was a gun or a wallet, like Amadou Diallo. And this happens again and again and again, and it becomes pretty clear it is not an accident. It is not the result of improper training. It is the police force playing a role that it is really out there to play. So how are you going to stop that?
Let me interrupt for 1 second, and I'll ask you that question right away, all right? But I want to let people know, so they should know, that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and one of the founding members of the October 22nd Coalition. So go ahead, Carl. Yeah, let's jump into how you're going to stop this, because you argue, and I've seen, you know, and we've talked about this many times on my show, you've written about it in Revolution Newspaper and other places, that actually what happens is you have a thing where, you know, you have all these things happening, and there's no way that this system can actually resolve you know, what they're faced with. And a lot of people will argue back to you that, well, really, there's no way, you know, really, can't we just, like, you know, do battle by battle, or can't we just, like, push a few things here? And look, you know, Holder is beginning to talk about, he's making moves around the, you know, the mandatory penalties for drugs, for drug possession and all this stuff. And Obama was actually finally came out and said something when he spoke about Trayvon. You know, there's all these things that people start to try to grab onto some kind of hope in the system. But you argue, and I think it's extremely important, there's no way this system can do away with this.
Yeah, see, because Holder is beginning to speak on that. Obama did go to the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington and acknowledge that there were problems, but say, look, I'm going to be working on them. You got people now who care about it. We know what this is. We experienced it. But people got to look at this on the real. Eric Holder has been in charge of the Justice Department for 4 years before he opened his mouth to say anything about this. And the reality is that more than 90% of the people in federal prisons are there for nonviolent offenses, and almost 50% of them are there for simple drug possession. So he's been presiding over this for 4 years. Now, he's talking about it now because of some things that happened, particularly the Trayvon verdict and particularly the response to it. So that's an attempt to keep people having faith in the system, to keep them thinking that maybe there's a way that this is going to work. But we can't be sucked in by that, because it ain't going to happen. Even if Holder takes a few steps, he's still sitting upon this edifice that has criminalized, dehumanized, and demonized many, many people. But the way it could be dealt with is through making revolution, getting rid of this system. Because, look, we need to live in a society where those who are entrusted with public safety would sooner risk their own lives than kill or injure an innocent person. And that's something that could happen, but it'll take a revolution to bring it about. I mean, Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, speaks to the police murder of Taisha Miller that happened, I believe, in Riverside, California, a number of years back, and he says, look, these cops got to get out of the way. The whole system's got to get out of the way if this is the best that you could do, because we could do way better than that. We could actually have a setup where the police, instead of being enforcers who instill terror, are involved in the community and helping people deal with problems. When they come upon a problem of somebody who is having a mental episode or contradictions among the people, they could involve people in helping to deal with those problems, as opposed to an occupation force that's going to come in with brutality and with murder to try to deal with those. And that's possible through revolution. And look, I can't get into all the details of this, but there is a draft constitution for a future socialist republic in North America that the Revolutionary Communist Party has published, which speaks to the kind of society that could be brought into being in the aftermath of a revolution in this country, including how would the rights of people and how would issues related to law enforcement and criminal justice be handled. And it brings out how it would be totally different than the way that things are go down on this front today. And this is something that people could find and dig into by going to the website, revcom.us.
Mm-hmm. And that site is actually also somewhere where people can find out an interview you did with Sansara Taylor recently called The Outrages of America and the Need for Revolution. Now, Carl, let me just press on this a little bit more, because, you know, I want to get a little bit more. We have about 6 or 7 minutes. I want to get into this just a little bit more, and I have a couple questions. One is the back on this one about the why this system can't resolve this stuff. You know, it really occurs to me, and I think this happened, this was brought out in an article in Revolution newspaper on Obama's speech, about all the lies that were tied up in Obama's speech and all the stuff that was going on. The real history of African-American people in this country. And it makes the point there that this white supremacy and all that that entails, including police brutality, which, while it strikes other people, you know, as well, and it's a broader question, but it is really, there's a lot of concentration. It's really one aspect, one very, very basic aspect and essential aspect of the oppression of black people. And that is bred to the bone, foundational to this system. And that's the thing that really, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, when you want to talk about that, why can't it resolve it? Because it's part of this system. Everything America is built on that kind of oppression.
Yeah, I mean, that's an important point to bring out, because from the very beginning, when you're talking about America, you're talking about a society founded on the dispossession and genocide carried out against the native inhabitants and the enslavement of people from Africa. And at every point along its development, when there were key nodal points like the Civil War, where it was possible to do something about one of these foundational things, that being the subjugation of black people, that was turned back. It was turned back again in the 1960s when there was massive struggle to get rid of the oppression of black people, and the forms of it changed each time, but the reality of its continuing to be brought down on people has remained the same. And that's really what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with something that is built into the fabric and framework of this system, and something that they would have to tear apart their own setup to do something about. And that's something that they are not going to do, don't want to do, and can't even do. Mm-hmm. And that's why it comes down to, it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to deal with this. And part of making revolution, I mean, you got to spread revolution everywhere and deal with the fact that for most people, they have bought into, well, revolution, that can't happen. They're too powerful, the people are too messed up, and there's not enough people who are down for revolution at this point. And all of that can be changed. And at the same time, the other part of getting ready for revolution is fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today to Carl Dix. Carl's from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and he's one of the founding members of the October 22nd Coalition. And we're talking about the upcoming National Day of Protest against Police Brutality. That brings up the question I wanted to ask you, because you have a lot of people, you know, talking about, like you say, look, the most important thing you can bring into things right now is the need for revolution and the fact that only revolution can resolve this. And related to that is also the work of Bob Avakian in terms of opening up the door and the possibility of a whole new world coming up. A lot of people ask, what's that got to do with fighting? What's that got to do with stepping, you know, we can't make a revolution now, and we got to fight now. So what's the relationship between the two?
Yeah, well, we definitely do have to fight now, because if we don't, we will be crushed by this system. But if you fight without a perspective of how you can actually win, then what happens is, even when you make gains, those gains can be turned against you. And just a particular on the front of police brutality and police murder, in the wake of the police murder of Amadou Diallo in New York City by members of the Street Crimes Unit, there was massive protest to get rid of the Street Crimes Unit. The authorities didn't back up so much that they sent the killer cops to jail, but they did say, okay, we'll disband the Street Crimes Unit and no longer do that, and we'll reform the way police work. And the reform that they brought in was stop and frisk. In other words, people fought, people won what appeared to be some gains, but what it came down to was an even more onerous form of police on top of people all the time. People need to fight, but people also need to see a way out, because if there is no way out, then the best that you're going to aim for is trying to get a little bit changed within the framework of an overall oppressive system. And then people will also get frustrated because they don't see where their struggle can go anywhere. So it's very important that the perspective, even in building resistance, that what has to be out there is that this resistance is part of getting ready and in position to get rid of this system once and for all and bring a totally different and far better way for people to live into being. And that's something that Avakian's work has opened the door to. And I really encourage people to check it out, as I call on them to step out on October 22nd. You know, students need to mobilize in their colleges and high schools and come out on the 22nd. Ministers should be doing sermons on October 20th and bringing their congregations out on the 22nd, everybody needs to be out there. And people need to go to the websites revcom.us and stopmassincarceration.org to stay up on the plans and to get resources and materials to aid them in these mobilizations.
All right, Carl, now one last question. And a couple of things I read that you had written recently, you posed three statements to people. If you blank, 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 can you tell people what those are? It was sort of a call to the day.
Yeah, in the call to the day, and if you burned with outrage around the murder of Trayvon Martin, if you couldn't sleep when the verdict on the Trayvon Martin's killer came down, whether you feel you've been living that verdict your whole life or you're just finding out about it, if you burn with anger or agony at living in such a society, you need to act on October 22nd. Protest police brutality, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. No more stolen lives. Wear black, fight back. Hoodies up.
All right, Carl, thank you very much. And for people who want to find out about, I guess they can find out about how to get hold of people, how to get hold of people in various cities in whatever city you're in, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Michigan, Grand Rapids, Michigan, wherever you are, you can go to one of the websites you mentioned, revcom.us, or you can also go, isn't there an October 22nd coalition website as well?
Yeah, I think it's October22nd.org.
Okay, so you can go to that or to the Stop Mass Incarceration Network website. Carl, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
All right, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and one of the founding members of the October 22nd Coalition. He's also part of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we've been talking about the upcoming October 22nd National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality, Repression, and Criminalization of a Generation. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Tim Cummings and Bill Brockdrop, two of the actors in The Normal Heart. Really looking forward to this one, so stay tuned.
Resisting arrest as they're kicked on the ground, searching their houses, calling them queer. I don't believe that sort of thing happens here. Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Boy, page 3 of the Sun. There's no nudes in Gay News or One magazine, but they still found excuses to call it obscene. Read how disgusting we are in the press, the Telegraph, People and Sunday Express. Molesters of children, corrupters of youth, it's there in the paper, it must be the truth. Try and sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey.
All right, welcome back. That's the Tom Robinson Band with Glad to Be Gay. All right? And take a look at the history of that song and you understand what kind of screwed up society we're living in. The man almost got run out of rock and roll for that song. All right? That's an amazing, amazing, very important song. And I chose it because the next segment of the show is one I've been really waiting to do for quite some time. And I went to see a production of The Normal Heart, Larry Kramer's Normal Heart. Really a remarkable, remarkable piece. And joining us to talk about this are two of the actors in the play, Tim Cummings. How you doing, Tim?
Hello.
And Bill Brockdrop.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Let's jump into this. Why don't one of you tell the listeners what the play is about? Tim, you got pointed to.
Yes, the play explores the epidemic of AIDS in its earliest incarnation before anybody knew what it was, what was happening, why it was affecting gay men before they could even find the virus. And it follows the story of a man named Ned Weeks, who is based on the author Larry Kramer. And he goes from somewhat of an unwilling participant to a full-blown activist, him and his friends. Along the way, he falls madly in love with a reporter from the Times named Felix, and that's played by Bill here. And so that somewhat electrifies his need to get some information about what's going on and get help, get people to wake up and pay attention.
Yeah, and I should let people know that actually, Tim, you play Ned.
I play Ned Weeks.
It extremely well. I have to tell you, we'll talk about that in a minute, but let's talk about why, what made you guys want to do the play? Bill, what made you want to do it? And you can tell people about your character, because your character, you're in love with Ned. You're also in some ways, just personality-wise, the very opposite, but you encompass another whole side of Ned that is actually there and you help to bring out, but you also, he helps to bring out something in you.
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, what's beautiful about the play is that it has an interesting political stance. It has a bold, a vibrant take on the early AIDS crisis, but it also has a love story in it as well. And so my character, Felix, I think represents that love story. But for him personally, it's interesting because this character is a man working at the New York Times who is not very out at work, is not an activist, saying, hey, things are fine the way they are. Let's just kind of leave them as they are. And through his love with Ned, I think grows to appreciate that kind of activist stance in a big way.
But now, why did you want to do this?
This is a seminal work. I mean, this play, it's a classic. And also, what is amazing to me about it is how prescient Larry Kramer was. He is like a Cassandra screaming in the wilderness. He had the gift of knowing what was going to come, and nobody believed him. And he is shouting from the rooftops. And this play was written and done in 85 originally, in the midst of the beginning of this crisis, when people didn't know what was happening or where this was coming from or why it was affecting gay men particularly. They had no idea why. And he wrote this play, which has anger about the government, anger about the complacency of the gay community, anger about everything. And he turns out to have been actually right about everything. Mm-hmm. So to be involved in it is a thrilling experience.
Tim, what made you want to do it?
Well, I play a lot of Jewish men and I like to yell at people. Just kidding.
Come over to my house, man. It'll get along well.
It's such an astounding role. It feels like Hamlet in a way.
Well, you made a point, and I read an interview with you where you said it was one of the hardest roles you ever expect to have.
It's still hard. It was hard auditioning for it. It was hard rehearsing it. It's hard performing it.
I mean, he's brilliant. He carries the entire thing.
Thank you, Bill. No wonder I'm in love with you. Not hard in a painful, negative, awful kind of way. Hard as in challenging, as in there's a lot to learn. There's a lot to grow from. And it's an incredibly important responsibility. It doesn't feel like doing a play. It feels like visiting a crime scene. It feels like being a detective and gathering pieces and making sure people understand what happened and why. So it's not about me. It doesn't feel like it's about me. It feels like it's about the cause, mm-hmm. which is why I'm able to justify a lot of the behavior that the character administers.
You know, Tim has filled our dressing room with pictures of people with AIDS, of activists from the time, of the heroes of that era. And we like to think that we are, you know, doing it for those people who don't have a voice anymore.
Mm-hmm. I'm very visual. I have to have it all before me. And so I've decorated one whole wall with pictures of Larry and pictures of Vito and pictures of men with lesions all over their faces and pictures of men lying in bed who look like Holocaust victims.
So we're hoping that you know, we are doing an honor for them because they don't have that voice anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, an honor for them, and actually, and as well, something that's very important for today, which I'll get to in a little bit down the line. I want to remind listeners you tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Tim Cummings and Bill Brockdrop, and they're two of the actors in, two of the main actors, although there's a few others that are around in there, too, that play very important roles in the Normal Heart, Larry Kramer's play about the AIDS epidemic, and actually, frankly, I got to say, the genocidal implications of everything that was going on back then and the need to stand up against that. You know, one of the things bringing up that question of genocide, it struck me, it was really heavy to me to find out that Kramer actually wrote the play after a visit to Dachau, the Nazi concentration camp in Germany back in the 1930s, 1940s, during the Hitler regime in Germany. It sort of brought a lot of things together that he had been going through and trying to see. And I got the sense there's actually that edge that is contained in this production of the play as well.
Mm-hmm. He compares it to the Holocaust constantly.
I think it's begging the question, how different is it really? Or similar? You know, I mean, what does it take to round up a bunch of undesirables and throw them in camps and kill them? Maybe not literally, but in a metaphorical way as well. I mean, it's...
And I think there was talk at that time, and this is in the early 80s, people didn't know. It was quite possible. There was talk about quarantine. There was talk about people with AIDS being put somewhere so that they couldn't get to the rest of us, you know? So this is not made up. His things happily did not go that far, but that kind of marginalization that happened with people is certainly analogous.
Well, look at this. When you look at the things about the definition of actually what it takes to become a genocide, there's the isolation of people, there's the character demonization of people. Many of these things, look, you had six-year-old kids. I remember there was this little boy somewhere in the Midwest who had AIDS. And
Ryan White?
Yeah. You know, and he was the devil incarnate.
Yeah, shunned from his school and everything. Yeah. That's why he became a public figure.
And then you had gay men who, when the police would come up, big rubber gloves, and it was all this, you know, and it was like people had been reduced to demonized animals and were no longer part of the human race. And then there was the purposeful, the very purposeful, which I think Larry's play speaks to very well, the purposeful ignoring of the thing, the purposeful, the refusal to even accept people as part of humanity. It's almost like the sooner you're gone, the better. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what really got me.
Well, the play has so much anger in it, and a righteous anger, talking about the government, talking about Koch at the time, the mayor of New York, who did very little to help in this time. Probably, they think, because he was maybe a closeted homosexual himself, and didn't want to be too associated with the gay community. So he calls people out, and he was doing it in 1985, which is what is so remarkable about the play.
And also very much tied up with that whole, you have Reagan, you have the rise of Christian fascism. Suddenly you had all these people like Jerry Falwell and, you know, who's the other large bloated toad that kept talking? he has a talk show every now and then, and he's the one who said that the people in Haiti were, you know, Pat Robertson, yes. It got it. Bloated toad, right?
That's what gave it away.
Call it what it is.
But, ribbit.
And Larry goes to town on all these people and all in the play. He doesn't hold anything back, and that's, I think, what's so visceral and exciting about this piece of theater.
Mm-hmm. Larry still talks about, to this day, and it's explored in the play, the notion of why are gay people so hated? Why is there so much internalized homophobia? Where does it come from? When will it change? When will the race of gay people evolve into extraordinary pride and not being ostracized, not being a subculture, not being a subculture who has to base their identity on promiscuity and, I don't know, being at the gym?
Right. And at the time, he was a pariah of the gay community because he was suggesting that maybe promiscuity is not such a good thing. The gay community had fought for the right to go to the baths, to fight for the right for sexual freedom.
Yep.
And he was well despised by many in the gay community at this time for saying, hey, promiscuity is not the answer.
Yeah. He wrote that book, Faggots, 1978, which, you know, cast him in a pretty negative light in the gay community.
You know, it's interesting because we're going to pursue that too. Not the book Faggots, but just that question of how Larry's cast in the community, but also I think in the larger world too, which is a really important thing. But I want to, you're prepared to do a little piece from the play, Tim. So I wanted you to tell people what this is, set it up and do a little piece and just give people a sense of it.
Okay, well, in scene 7, which is the last scene in act 1, this is when Ned is pretty much in full-blown activist mode. He goes home to Felix, and he receives a phone call, and it's a newspaper asking for his editorial. So he pulls out a piece of paper and he says, "It is no secret that I consider the mayor to be, along with the Times, the biggest enemy that gay men and women must contend with in New York. Until the day I die, I will never forgive this mayor or this paper for ignoring this epidemic that is killing so many of my friends." All right, here's the end. "And every gay man who refuses to come forward now and fight to save his own life is truly helping to kill the rest of us. How many of us have to die before you get scared off your ass and into action? Thank you." And he hangs up the phone.
See, you get a taste of that, all right? We're talking with Tim Cummings and Bill Brockdrop, two of the actors in The Normal Heart. Now, tell me this. You know, one of the things that I was thinking about with in relation to Larry Kramer, there is a point in all of this where, and this is something that was really driven home to me, and as I was sitting there, I was, you know, you found yourself, you're like, you're just, your eyes are welling up, you're in tears, and then you're enraged, you know, and you keep, and it keeps going through this cycle. And it eventually, it just becomes this thing where you, you know, and especially with the end and when it pops up with the, you know, the number of dead, and you're thinking about how this continues on. But the fact that actually one of the things that Larry did with this, that whole point about when you know something is right, when you know something is wrong, or when you know something is right, and you know it has to be done, you have to do it. And that seems to infuse your character, Tim. It seems to infuse Ned. And I think you too, Bill, in terms of where Felix comes towards the end, where he actually is encouraging Ned to never stop fighting.
Yes.
You know, which was a really, really interesting stand, because this is the point where epistemology meets morality, okay?
Mm. What a great way of saying that. I like
Indeed.
That. Epistemology meets morality. That's
well
awesome.
Said.
And I think it happens in this play. I do. It takes the political and the personal and melds them together in a way that very few plays that I've read do. And I think that's why we were both so attracted to it. And I think that's why Simon Levy, the director, was attracted to it. He was looking for a story that brought the political and the personal together in a love story. And that's what The Normal Heart is.
Hmm.
Well said again. Wow.
Aren't we all gone? We all clever?
All eyes are on you now. See, the entire station is like standing at the window looking at you.
Well, should I do a number? Can I sing a song?
Oh, you could do it. He does everything in this play. I mean, it does. It's like he is. It's easy to fall in love with him. That's all I can say.
I begged for more of that amazing early 80s music that was around at this time, but it was just, I guess, too happy to listen to Blondie and Kim Carnes. But I wanted it, damn it.
I frankly am really glad. Not that I have anything.
But there's something that Tim's character says at the end, which is, "I wish I should have fought harder," which is so interesting for a person who is fighting as hard as humanly possible. And I think that's what is sort of moving to all of us, because there is something of an indictment to all of our passivity in not having done enough and not doing enough now for any cause. You know, there are so many causes, you get hit by everything, and so do you sort of think, oh, well, that's a sad story for those people, what can I do? And yet the idea that we can do more, every one of us can do more, is something that's infused in this whole play. And so when you hear a guy who's done everything saying, "I wish I could do more," something very moving about that to me.
When I do that moment, I think a lot about the documentary How to Survive a Plague, which is a beautiful documentary. It was one of the most helpful to me when I was doing all of my massive amounts of research for this play, and because it follows a period of the early 80s up until the current times of ACT UP, the creation of ACT UP, and all of the men in ACT UP fighting to get help from the health department, drugs, ways to keep this disease under control. And they fought so hard and for so long, and they were so relentless, and that was the only way that they achieved any success. And so I could imagine Ned in this situation. There goes the love of his life, has just died. Why? Because he feels like he didn't do enough.
We're talking with Tim Cummings and Bill Brockdrop, two of the actors in The Normal Heart, the seminal play written by Larry Kramer, by playwright Larry Kramer, back in the 1980s. And it's about the early years of the AIDS crisis and all of the terrible, terrible things that came down on gay men in particular because of that disease. They were dehumanized, alienated, isolated. And frankly, there was a lot of genocidal implications in that whole scene. You know, it's interesting. I know what you're saying about what Ned feels and what Larry Kramer feels in terms of, you know, his personal responsibility versus things that, look, you know, one of the things I just did a show on a part of a show on a new film called Fire in the Blood, which is a really intense film because it talks about, you know, AIDS and where it's at today, and in particular the way it's just impacted the third world in huge ways. And when you talk about those 30 million deaths that as of now, you know, how many of them are impacted. I used to see the New York Times used to run a list after in the 90s, they started running a picture of the AIDS map of the world, you know, and it would, they'd have stick figures showing, you know, where the populations were. I can't remember how many each figure represented. But when it got to the continent of Africa, it was the only continent that was completely blotted covered out by stick people. And it was went out into the oceans on all sides. And it was like, you know, it's horrendous. And actually the drug companies were refusing to allow generic drugs into Africa. And so you had, they were where a treatment course would be like $25,000, $30,000, whatever it is a year. Most people in Africa couldn't come anywhere near paying that. And there were no resources to pay that. But generic drugs, somebody manufactured a generic drug treatment. When the cocktails came out, the antiretroviral treatment came out, there was a company in India that manufactured one of the drugs that actually would cost less than a dollar a day. And there was a fight to keep that out of Africa because of intellectual property rights. I love that, intellectual property rights, you know, and profits and and what do you call it? Patents, you know, and that's the thing. And so you look at and something when you look at that sort of that systemic thing that was going on, I think very much the same thing in relation to what was happening in the 80s and what's happening, what's intensified in that play or concentrated in that play, including the fact silence equals death. Mm-hmm. You know, because that's AIDS, yes, ACT UP, they were trying to get, you know, medication and treatment and all this stuff. But there was also very much that point about silence equals death.
Yep.
We cannot be silent in the face of this.
Yeah, this play is set just before the formation of ACT UP, the organization that Tim's character is forming in his living room is really based on the gay man's health crisis, which was a little, little before that. And ACT UP came just after this play, when people were getting more frustrated, more angry, and more people were getting involved, and they obviously did a great job of changing the entire tenor of the conversation.
When I got to New York City in the early 90s to study at New York University, silence equals death was everywhere, and you didn't have sex with men, certainly not without a condom. They gave out condoms in the lobbies of the dorms. They gave out condoms in the dining halls. Silence equals death was everywhere. People wore it on their t-shirts. It was posted all over the West Village. You had to be really, really, really careful. I mean, they had the disease under control, but you still didn't want to get it. It was a death sentence. So I just remember that being that my generation of gay men was different from 10 years prior. Mm-hmm. What was happening in 1981 versus what was happening in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. It's astonishing.
Yeah. Well, let me say real quick, we're talking with Tim Cummings and Bill Brockdrop, two of the actors in The Normal Heart. I have one more question for you guys, and it's an important one because it's Simon Levy, the director of the play, made a comment where he said he talked about his role as an artist is to awaken or reawaken the public to important social and political issues. My mission is to help people remember what's right. And I really like that, you know,
yeah,
and I left
beautiful.
The theater feeling very, very much motivated in terms of a sense of when you know something is unjust, act. What do you guys think of that?
Well, what's not to like about that? It's just, you know, I think it's a question of being able to put aside some of your daily chores and the trip to the market and pick up the kids and all that kind of stuff to find the time to really do something. But I will say this, the people I feel like the ACT UP crowd did an amazing job of making this disease heard and known about. But the quiet comings out of regular gay and lesbian Americans across the country also changed the tenor of things.
But let me ask you this, and this will be the last question because I think we have about 2 or 3 minutes, maybe 2.5 minutes to answer this. But here's the point, though, is that one of the things that's polemicized in the play, that's polemicized against in the play, is the fact that you had too many men, even in the gay community, who were willing to be silent for their personal security, and you know, one might say, well, you can understand it, but it's very similar. And Larry Kramer kept posing, at what point do all the Jews say, no, we have to stand up?
Mm-hmm.
You can't say, I want my job at Citibank, therefore I'm not going to say
no. That's why I think coming out as a gay or lesbian person is the single most important thing you can do.
power in numbers. Are you a man or a mouse?
All right. Well, all right. Well, that's a way. On that note, we will end it. And folks, I'm telling you, this is an amazing play. And I want to thank both of you guys, Bill Brocktrup and Tim Cummings, who actually, you know, I got to say it, you two, it was really great. And the fact that the synergy that developed between the two characters. And actually, oh, you know what? Real quick, maybe you can do this because this is something I really wanted to find out. You had, and somebody, I read this somewhere that made this point, and I thought, that's right. Your character, Tim, is so huge in everything he does, his voice, his arguments, his ideas, and it requires so much space, and you have so little space to do it in. I wanted to talk to you about how you did that, and especially your body movements, man. I thought that concentrated so much. That stuff that actually looked like, in some cases, looked like it was taken from, like, old Three Stooges films. But it was, like, great because it really concentrated so much.
Physicality is a big thing for me as an actor, and I always – it's the thing that I spring everything from, so – that just came naturally out of the emotions that came up in moments of extreme outrage and sorrow. And as for the rest of it, you know, we're still sort of figuring out the best way to balance out how much size and rage and volume there is in that tiny little space. But I also feel like that's the point. And that Larry, if anybody, would be the most proud of it being so in your face. And look, I'm not out there to perform and make people feel comfortable. So if it's too loud for you and it's too uncomfortable, good.
But it's thrilling to see this kind of a play in an intimate space. That's the cool thing.
I agree. Yeah. I really appreciated it. And before we leave this part of the show, there's something I want to read to you from Bob of Aiken. It's particularly significant in relation to the talk we've been having about the play The Normal Heart, but I also think it fits in well with the whole first segment of the show about police brutality and the need to stand up against that. And again, this is from Bob of Aiken, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's from his book Basics. There is a place where epistemology and morality meet. There is a place where you have to stand and say, it is not acceptable to refuse to look at something or to refuse to believe something because it makes you uncomfortable. And it's not acceptable to believe something just because it makes you feel comfortable. Once again, that's from Bob Avakian and his book, Basics. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I'd like to thank all of my guests today, Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and one of the founding members of the October 22nd Coalition Against Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation. And I'd also like to thank Tim Cummings and Bill Brocktrup, who we've just been talking with from Larry Kramer's seminal play, The Normal Heart. I also want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow us, you can on Twitter and Facebook. And again, if you want to help produce the show, get the show out there, contribute in whatever way you can in terms of research, suggesting guests, helping to transcribe interviews and whatnot, write me at michaelslate@redfuture.com, all right? And because anything you can do would be deeply appreciated. And it's a lot of fun, all right? It doesn't matter where you live because we got something called the internet. So keep that in mind. And on that note, we're going to go out with Revolution from Dr. John.